യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദികേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാദ് വിവരണസ്യ ച. So we are continuing this very important discussion, Ashtanga Yoga. So we have to keep in mind the background. Patanjali's Yoga Sutras have got 195 sutras divided into four chapters. In the printed book, you find the order is Samadhipada, Sadhanapada, Vibhudipada and Kaivalyapada. The first one dealing with contemplation, concentration. The second one dealing with means, practices. The third one dealing with different psychic powers, special intellectual, spiritual faculties that you develop as you practice yoga. And the fourth one, liberation. So we discussed the first few sutras of Samadhipada because they deal with the definition and the fundamental purposes and some of the essential characteristics of yoga as a whole. So, but we didn't finish that Samadhipada. We will discuss that again. And after that we started the Sadhanapada, which has got three important subjects of discussion. One, Kriya Yoga, Tapa, Swadhyaya, Isharan, Pradhanani. We discussed. That particular section deals with some of the common obstacles that we encounter in spiritual life. How the accumulated impressions and memories, samskaras and vasanas, throw up some unexpected obstacles and problems when we take to spiritual life. To understand this, of course, though we left that subject far behind, but still I can give an example, very striking example. Obstacles we discussed. Kleshah, avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha, kleshah. Some of these obstacles are later discussed under the category antaraya means. Now, well, you can find in your life when you have no problem. When you are quite satisfied with a mundane life, when your whole energy and time and activities are focused on acquiring secular, worldly prospects, enjoyments, you have no problem. When you try to turn a new leaf, when you take the spiritual life, suddenly you find many problems do arise. Or rather, we start looking upon new impediments and obstacles in spiritual life. When you try to meditate, mind is not steady. Obstacles. Thought currents frequently disturbing the mind. There's no problem when people were happy going to nightclub. Spending the whole time just going to resort centers. Practically nothing beyond the present, beyond the sensory process, no problem at that stage. Because we belong to that stage. When we try to evolve to a higher state of consciousness, we have problems, which shows that we are progressing. So if you have a problem, it means you are progressing. So every time we try to take to spiritual life, contemplative life, we suddenly happen to face some problems. But these are really not problems. They are the sign, they're signposts which indicate that we are progressing, we are evolving, we are going ahead in spiritual life. So we discussed that far behind, long back. And then we discussed the quadrangle of grief, Dukkha Chadurvyuha. That also we discussed. And right now we are discussing the third important topic of Sadhanapada, that is Ashtanga Yoga, which has got 8 important ingredients. Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, Samadhi. These are the eight limbs, I may call, means 8 parts. One would say 8 stages in spiritual life. Yama and Niyama, as I mentioned earlier, deal with 10 disciplines, 10 fundamental disciplines in life. So, self-restraint, that is yama, observances, niyama, posture, asana. So that's again an important point. Asana is just translated as posture. So asana is a posture. Then one may, if you read Gheranda Samhita, Hatha Yoga Pratipika, and Shiva Samhita, these are the 3 fundamental textbooks in Hatha Yoga. Which Shiva Samhita refers to a large innumerable types of postures. Gheranda Samhita and Hatha Yoga Pratipika demonstrates and explains different physical postures. Now, but the whole topic is discussed under one single word, asana. So asana is nothing but a posture. Now, what about these different postures that we, the people, practice in yoga studios? They're all necessary, they'll be of great service for us to sit quiet and meditate for a long time in a very, very effortless, tranquil, peaceful, and happy state. So, sthira sukham asana, you find the definition, Patanjali. Sthairya means steadiness. It's a noun form of sthira. Sthira is an adjective. So, you should be able to sit straight. And there should not be any effort involved. You should feel that you are not doing anything. See, if you are doing something and you also feel... If you also feel very strongly that you're doing something, it means there is an effort. If you lift a very heavy stone on your head, which is far beyond your ability to bear, then it's a great effort. You feel it. But if you lift a small stone, you won't feel any effort. So, how to reach a state of effortlessness while sitting quiet? Meditation. I've seen... when I had to visit some yoga teaching centers, very muscular, well-built, athletic-looking men sitting, trying to sit rather in straight posture, with muscles, bulging muscles, with a grim expression on their face. It means they're working very hard, as if they're fighting against somebody, some kind of wrestling competition or boxing competition. So much of strain, so much effort. Of course, that's the beginning. Now, if one should be able to sit with the same level of steadiness, but with complete effortlessness, complete joy, because joy and effortlessness are interrelated. When you feel you are doing something with a great effort, when you feel the effort, there is no joy. So, that sitting position should become natural, effortless, and then it becomes a joyful experience. That is sthairyam and sukham. Sthira means steady and for a long time. 2 meanings. You should be able to sit steady for a long time. At the same time, it should be totally free from any feeling of effort and strain. That is asana. So, all these yogic postures, yogic physical postures, are preparations for one to be able to sit in a steady posture for a long time. Steadiness of posture is related to another very important factor. You should be able to focus on something, then only you will be able to sit steady. You can very easily see when you have, when you hear a terrible, shocking experience, your whole mind is focused on that. You sit, immediately the body becomes alert. It may be a great shock or it may be a great joyful experience. Any kind of exclamation makes you focused on something. So if one could meditate on a single idea for a long time without effort, without any physical strain, and for a long time, with a sense of joyfulness, it is called asana. So I wanted to explain this. We'll discuss this subject later. Pranayama, of course, we discussed, is breathing exercises, which have got different formations, different types. Of course, great traditional teachers will always tell you not only the method but also the dangers. The difference between a very commercial teacher and the traditional teacher is this. A traditional teacher will tell you the risks involved. Commercial teacher may not always do that. So breathing exercises are very, very important. That's one classic example. Those who can read the works of Swami Sivanandaji of Rishikesh, who is the founder of Divine Law Society, with the first great teacher in modern times, who discussed Hatha Yoga and all related topics, brought it to modern world, especially the physical part of it, and his disciples, his movement. So dharana is fixing the mind on a single object. And of course, the pratyahara means withholding the senses from external things. For that, you have to draw the senses towards something inward. So you cannot really withdraw the senses from external objects without withdrawing them towards an internal focus. So both go together. That is called pratyahara. Withholding the senses, fixing the mind is dharana. Meditation is dhyana, and perfect concentration is samadhi. So we gave a brief description of this earlier. Now the next sutra, 30th sutra, is Ahimsa, Satya, Asteya, Brahmacharya, Abhirigraha, Yamah. Yamas are explained. Yama is nothing but restraints, which is really more difficult and more important and more universal and much more significant than niyamas in spiritual life. We'll find out why. So one is abstinence from injury. Ahimsa. Satya means truthfulness. Abstinence from theft. Even the thought, idea, all should be avoided. Any thought of violence or falsehood or theft, even an idea, a flashing thought, will have its impact on the mind, because whatever comes in the mind produces its after effect. So the main purpose is to go beyond even the idea of violence, the idea of untruth, the idea of theft, the idea of covetousness, etc. So first is ahimsa. We discussed at length in the last class. Second is truthfulness, satyam. Satyam is a very, very difficult thing to fully understand. Here, satyam, one way we can say the simplest definition is satya corresponds to placing the thought in the mind, words and actions on the same level. That is one understanding of satya. But in actual practice, what does it mean? You sometimes come across people who claim to be outspoken. And sometimes that outspoken nature may be very harmful to themselves and very insulting to others. So Manusmriti, the ancient lawgiver, gives a very interesting definition of what satyam really implies satyam bruyat priyam bruyat na bruyat satyam apriyam priyam cha na anudam bruyat esha dharma sanatanaha. So Manu says dharma sanatana dharma mean the eternal spiritual paradigm. He says you should speak the truth, and you should speak the truth in a way that is not deliberately unpleasant to others, need not necessarily be made pleasant for others to hear, but should not necessarily be unpleasant. So to explain the point, na bruya satyam apriyam. So a person with maybe difficult in walking, or maybe difficulty in seeing. So you don't call him hunchback or anything like that. You don't call him that. You do not use terms which may be literally true, but then which may not be necessary there. So Manu gives his practical application. Na bruya satyam apriyam. Apriyam satyam na bruya. A truth which may be irrelevant, which may be literally true, which may be unpleasant to others, which may be unnecessary for you to speak out, you need not do that. So that's the definition. And even if there is a truth, that truth should be something, it should be spoken in a way that is pleasant to others. Priyam chana anudam bruyat. Priyam means pleasant to hear. So, one possibility is, we may speak an unpleasant truth which should be avoided. Where it is not necessary to speak an unpleasant truth, you need not speak that unpleasant truth. At the same time, you need not please a person by saying something which may be pleasant for him to hear, but it may be the opposite of truth. So seek a fancy, things like that. So priyam cha na anudam bruyat. Esha dharma sanatanah. So three possibilities are anticipated by Manu, and he says we should avoid these three possibilities. One is speaking an unpleasant truth where it is not called for, where it is not necessary to say that. And then to speak truth in an unpleasant manner. So to speak an unpleasant truth, or speaking a truth in a very unpleasant manner, both are equally undesirable. Again, to speak the opposite of truth means falsehood. Just to please somebody, that also is wrong. So these are the possibilities. And Manu, the great commentator, lawgiver, who wrote this Manu Smriti maybe in the 8th or 9th century BC, he anticipates these possibilities and gives and lays down the principles. So the satyasteya, it's obvious, having no interest or thought or ideas, leave alone actions related to stealing something that belongs to others. Brahmacharya is continence. It is an established fact that the highest spiritual truth cannot be practiced or implemented or even understood intellectually without practicing these virtues, self-restraint. But you have to remember, many of the great sages, many of the great lawgivers, they were all householders. They were householders. They were married people. And a good number of them, after leading the householder's life for some time, retired to forest hermitages, and there they led contemplative life, absolutely free from any kind of sensory pleasures, which enabled them to expound these great books and preach great truths. Of course, many of them were great monks, nuns, and many of them were retired householders. Some of the greatest sages were all householders, teachers, who have, after completion of their what we call Grihastha-ashrama, I mean Brahmacharya Garhasthya Vanaprastha, after spending their life as Grihasthas, I mean householders, they took to forest hermitages. That's why it is said, Manu himself says, Grihasthasu ida pasid vali palidam atmanaha apatyasya apatyam tada aranyam samasya. This is a great statement in Manu. So the literal meaning is this. A householder, when he sees that his hair, the hair is getting gray and his face is getting wrinkled, what he should do? And when he sees the face of his grandson or granddaughter, he should not go about going for plastic surgery or dyeing the hair or whitening the teeth or blackening the hair, nothing. Instead of that, tada aranyam samasayet. Aranyam means forests. Any place of contemplation, vijanam is the Sanskrit word for forest, one of the synonyms. Vigata janam means that there is nobody. Solitude, that's a meaning. Not necessarily forests. Solitude. Even old age homes can be solitude, can be aranyam in that sense. So, because they, after some years, they sublimated the energy, their whole focus or consciousness of life to a higher level. So, Brahmacharya. Aparigraha. Aparigraha is complete freedom, complete absence of covetousness. Disayama. So, of course, the great sages gave a very graphic description of what pure life is. Smaranam, kirtanam, keli, prekshanam, guhyabhashanam, sangalpo, adhivasayascha, kriya, nishpatti, revacha. Edat maithunyam ashtangam, parvadanti, manishinaha, vibridam, brahmacharyam, anushteyam, mukshubhi. So it means, literally it means, one should mentally keep away from any kind of indulgence, either through conversation, through thinking, through contemplation, or any kind of mental or physical or verbal indulgence in any of these sensual thoughts, and sublimate time, energy, and whole consciousness and mental focus to a higher level. Great sages used to do this by retiring to hermitages or places of contemplation after some years of leading householder's life. It's a very sublime concept of integrated life, where you study as a young man. You study, then this was the common. There were many monks who became monks right from the infancy. Of course, great monks were who Shankaracharya started his spiritual mission when he was just less than 7 years old. So like that, there are grand examples even today. But this is the common paradigm of life meant for the whole humanity. So if the whole humanity can order their life on the basis of these four stages, you can find there is a perfect harmony and integrity, a very holistic concept of life as a whole. This is called Yama. Now, Patanjali doesn't stop there. He goes beyond that. So he says, the yama should be practiced not only at the action level, means you should avoid action related to himsa or violence or theft, but you should also avoid action, even thoughts, words and deeds related to violence or anything, even mentally, verbally, not only physically, but even mentally and verbally, one should be completely free from all this. Because gross action and subtle mental ideation or verbal or mental contemplation on violent activities will have the same effect of polluting the mind or creating undesirable, spiritually harmful memories and samskaras in the mind. This should be avoided. But then in the next sutra, the 31st sutra, he says, Ede jadi desha kala samaya anavachinnaha sarvabhaumaha mahavratam. So he uses an adjective to these restraints. It means non-violence, truthfulness, abstinence from theft, continence, and non-covetousness. He says these disciplines are very universal. They are not meant for any particular place, class, time, or related any duty or culture. And incidentally, you find in all traditions, not only in the tradition of yoga and Vedanta, in all traditions, wherever a great person, a great man or woman have taught high spiritual ideas, have written about spiritual life, are still remembered for their spiritual dimension. They have practiced this. Without practicing any of these disciplines, one cannot even become a successful person, even in the secular life. Because once we restrain our mind from undesirable actions, thoughts and words, then the mind is lifted to a higher level, mental actions and energy are sublimated, and out of that sublimated energy, great thinkers, great scientists, great artists, great musicians, not only great mystics and spiritual teachers, they are born. So that's why he is Sarvabhauma. Sarvabhumishu, Sarvavisheshu, Sarvatha eva, Avidita vibhicharaka Sarvabhauma Mahavadam itichade. So the great commentator Vyasa says, everywhere in this world, in all respects, in all ways, in all possible methods, one should practice this universal discipline. After discussing niyamas, we will come back to the subject because there are more important ideas related to this in the commentaries. So these are niyamas. Niyamas are shauja, santosha, tapaswadhyaya, ishara pridhanani niyamaha. So they call observances. These are restraints. I mean, all energy and time and faculties are prevented from being diverted into undesirable, unhealthy channels. Those channels are blocked and closed. So our energy, time, our consciousness, everything is diverted to positive channels. That's the purpose of yama. Then five observances are explained. Shauja, santosha, tapa, swadhyaya, ishara, pranidhanani. Cleanliness, external cleanliness like bath, etc. Internal cleanliness is explained in some other sutras. For example, in another context, Patanjali himself says, it comes in the Samadhipada, 17th or 33rd sutra, how to acquire internal cleanliness, mental cleanliness. And if you acquire mental purity or cleanliness, you feel an inexplicable inner joy, restfulness, complete restfulness, a complete joy and effortlessness, which is called Chitta Prasadhanam by Patanjali. Elsewhere in the Samadhipada, that is in the 33rd verse, he says, Maitri Karuna Mudida Ubekshanam Sukha Dukha Punya Apunya Vishayanam Bhavanataha Chitta Prasadhanam. This is the sutra where Patanjali elaborates further in another context the methods to achieve this mental purity. So you have to remember Patanjali Sutras are closely interrelated. One could, at least you can teach Patanjali Sutra only mostly if you know the whole sutra memorized. The reason was that's the method in which these sutras are formulated. Old ancient method when people had nothing to do except memorizing all these. There was no other subject to learn. You know. So and they mostly learn through oral tradition. The teacher will repeat three times, and that should be enough for the student to memorize, and he will repeat. That's how these sutras were taught and studied. So these are interrelated. It is not that we read from one chapter to another chapter. No, they are closely interrelated, dealing with the whole mechanism, the dynamics of mental control, mental sublimation. So, how does the mind acquire this kind of internal purity and tranquility? Because purity and tranquility are closely related. Restless mind becomes restless because there is a conflict going on within that mental system between good and bad vrittis and thought currents and samskaras, which are sometimes the causes of phobias, obsessions, even many kinds of delusions, delusions of reference, delusions of grandeur, delusions of persecution. Many of these are related to the mutual conflict between good and bad samskaras, the struggle between two opposing types of categories of samskaras in mind. So once you transcend this conflict, the mind attains a level of tranquility. And Patanjali says here, this tranquility, this internal purity is achieved by cultivating friendliness towards people who are spiritually advanced, who are fellow spiritual seekers, whose association will help you in your own spiritual life. Or compassion towards those who are good people but who are suffering. Or admiration towards those who are more advanced than you. So you can see the opposite qualities are negated. So one should not be jealous. One should not have any hostility or envy towards those who are fellow spiritual seekers. And one should be able to admire those who are more advanced than you. Because frequently what you admire in others, that's what you really will achieve. So a student who admires a scientist like Einstein or Newton may one day become a great scientist. Because this idealization, looking upon a great person who has achieved something great in one or other area of activity, that produces the same tendency. So friendliness, absence of jealousy and envy towards those who are practicing spirituality like us, compassion, not contempt for those who are not as advanced as you, and admiration, even the absence of jealousy towards those who are more advanced than you. The ability to admire, the ability to enjoy the progress, the goodness, the achievement of others is one of the characteristics of spiritual growth. It doesn't mean that you should admire everyone, but it is said, one of the statements in the Shankara's commentary, Shankaracharya says, if you have a friend who feels a great inner joy at your own prosperity, which he even does not express in words, he is a real friend. So the ability to feel joy when you are happy, I think I mentioned this in the winter, during the winter retreat session. There's a dialogue in the Mahabharata between two great sages, with a deep psychological insight. Who's your best friend? That's the subject. Two options. One, a person who is unhappy when you're unhappy and willing to help you. The other option, a person who is very happy when you are happy, when you succeed. So the conclusion at the end of this dialogue is this. The one who helps you when you are in difficulty may be your friend. But the moment you're out of this terrible need, he feels unhappy because he has no scope to help you. He wants that you should be always miserable. And then he feels an inner joy and then he wants to help you. That's all. Not necessarily. He may be your best friend, of course. But not necessarily. In Sanskrit we call vikalpa. There is a possibility of another option. But the person who feels real joy when you are successful, when you are happy, he will certainly be your friend. No doubt about it. The other person may be your friend, but not necessarily. When you are out of this difficulty, he may feel slightly unhappy. There's a possibility. So these are very interesting discussion. Now the greatest sign of a really good person is he is happy when you are happy. He may not express it. So the mudita. And then upayeksha. So that's called maitri, karuna, mudita, upekshanam. That means in total indifference towards those whose association may be unhelpful, not necessarily very helpful. Sukhadukha punya apunya vishayanam bhavanataha chitta prasadana. So this now we'll come back to the subject, our present sutra. So this is shaucha, internal purity. Santosha, when you get internal purity, you feel joy. The santosha, that joy is not necessarily the absence of grief. Generally, any kind of joy that we feel at the sensory level is not necessarily a joy. It is only the absence of misery. But real joy is positive joy itself. It's like a coin with only one side. You feel as if you don't have anything more to strive for or to achieve. The tapa. Tapa is again austerity, self-denial, focusing the mind. Chitta ikagriyam means focusing the mind upon one great object, even renouncing everything else. Then study of scriptures, study of books. It may be through listening, it may be many other means. Books that are helpful or associating oneself, linking oneself to great ideas through listening, through reading, of any of these means. And complete surrender to God. Because this surrender has got a great psychological significance. When a person sincerely surrenders himself to God, then what happens? We feel a kind of relief. The relief comes because when we empty our own mind of all egotism, then the will of the Supreme Lord interferes and he enters our system and he begins to operate. So we feel naturally an effortlessness. As we feel a great, huge burden is taken off our shoulders. This is Ishvara Paridhana. Now, here, the commentators give very elaborate interpretations to the Yama and Niyama. That's a very interesting subject. So he says, you know, the Patanjali himself says, Yama are universal spiritual values. If you do not practice Yama, then we go down. If a person practices only Niyama and completely neglects Yamas, he may go down. This is an explanation in the other commentaries. Ahimsa Satyavajanam Brahmajaryam Akalpada Aste Midi Panchayade Yama Parigirtidaha Yama Akrodho Guru Susrusha Saujam Akharilakhavam Apramadasya Sadadam Panchayade Niyama Smurtaha. So, non-violence, speaking the truth, then continence, then freedom from all kinds of wickedness, non-stealing, these are niyamas, and then absence of anger, serving teachers, restraint control of food, then correct understanding of things, these are all these five niyamas. Now here, again, Manu, the great lawgiver, explains further. Yaman seveda satadam nanityam niyaman buddha. Yaman padadi akurvano niyaman kevalan bhajan. Now let's discuss this point. Suppose a person practices, say, niyamas. I mean, cleanliness, he takes bath properly every day. He works very hard, tapa, great mental concentration. He is well read, and he also has a sense of complete surrender, but he is violent and is prone to thieving. You can imagine that person will go down. You can find some of the great scourges of humanity, great villains the world has produced. They had many of these qualities. You could see they were well-read, intellectually advanced, great power of concentration. And they had their own idea of religion and spirituality, complete surrender to God, only to do more evil things. Because the idea of God was equally evil, so they could surrender their will to that God. So all these niyamas could be practiced by people who are not necessarily spiritual. That's the difference between civilization and culture. Civilization goes skin deep. Civilization frequently means urbanization, high technology, higher levels of organizational skill, more sophistication, external sophistication, the ability to do things more efficiently. All these are possible by people who may be practicing some of the niyamas, because niyamas are observances. Some of them have only external, the physical level. Taking bath 3 times a day, very hard working. I mean, self-denial. You find that many persons who are remembered for the cruelty, for the damage that humanity has suffered because of them, had all these qualities: strong willpower, great power of concentration, and ability to organize, intellectual achievement, study, and of course, their idea to surrender themselves to an ideal, to their own idea of God. They were very good in practicing these observances, niyamas. So Manu, the great lawgiver, says, Yaman padadi akurvano, Niyaman kevalan bhajan. So kevalan niyaman bhajan. Yaman akurvanaha patati. Means a person who practices all niyamas but does not practice yamas, great restraints, which only make him cultured. Because this is the difference between culture and civilization. Culture has got an element of spirituality, higher ethics in it, culture. It's called Sanskrit, it's called Parishkriti. So Parishkriti has something to do, means makes it cleanliness, purity. The other one is, Samskriti is the word for culture. Samskriti. So Samskriti involves inner refinement. So inner refinement, inner purity, inner processing. As I said, it has got a spiritual element in culture or Samskriti. The other aspect is civilization, which is called Parishkriti in Sanskrit. So Parishkriti, if you look at the Roman civilizations, the great military, the Roman roads, Roman aqueducts, Roman organization, and Roman engines, of war, the ruthlessness, the blood feuds, all these are associated with the Roman civilization. But high efficiency, the models of efficiency, organization, skill. So all the Roman roads were used for chariots, for making war, for marching the Roman armies. So there is a comparison between Hannibal Barca, who was the great Carthaginian general who fought in the Second Punic War, and Africanus, who was the last general, the great Carthaginian general. Hannibal defeated the Romans in 4 great battles and almost annihilated Roman power, Roman army. 4 times, not once, 4 times. And Hannibal did not have advanced stone-throwing engines, the mighty Roman tools of war. He didn't have. And his soldiers were also not so well-trained. They were not professional soldiers, Roman soldiers. He recruited the tribes from all over, wherever he went, and made them fight. But he was a one man, but super genius he was. He's a great military tactician and strategician. So a great comparison in Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. So he says, it's a very interesting point. There was something that goes beyond the human, beyond the outer levels of efficiency and sophistication with Hannibal. Hannibal Barca was his name. He's Hamilcar Barca, he was father, and his elder brother was Hasdrubal Barca. So this Hannibal was a mighty big genius, he was the one associated with the Second Punic War, maybe in 3rd century BC. So Hannibal could inspire the wild tribes from Spain, Italy, and wherever he went, and made them all fight for him, to die for him, and against the best-trained professional soldiers of those times, against the mightiest imperial power of that time, the imperial Rome. How he could do that? So he made them feel that they had a higher cause. They had something to sacrifice for Carthage. So he says, you can see the difference between culture and civilization. He doesn't elaborate. Hannibal had a higher culture in the sense his armies were less trained, less sophisticated, less efficient. Rome had the best professional army of those times, the only standing army, the only empire in the world which had a standing army at that time. But they were much more sophisticated in civilization, the gadgets, the tools in war making tools. That's Gibbon seen Decline and Fall of Roman Empire. Anyway, I'm not going far into Roman history. But the point is this, niyamas can make a nation great by making use of external tools human nature and also tools from external nature. Not only human nature, from external natural world. So it could produce great urban civilization, urban things. But culturally, such a civilization may be very low in spiritual values, in human values. But culture, on the other hand, as the additional element of dharma in it. Civilization is artha and kama, and dharma only to enjoy this artha and kama, means the external sense, external prosperity. But culture has got a higher element, and culture is related to yama. Yamas. That's why Patanjali says sarvabhauma mahabhutam. So these yamas, you know, non-violence, ahimsa, truthfulness, absence of theft, then non-covetousness, and then higher spiritual values. These are related to higher human culture. So he says, a person, as Manu says, a person who practices all the niyamas, but no yama, will go down, will perish himself. That's what Manu says in this context. So now we'll have interaction. You can start your discussion as you want. See this happen.
Swamiji, you mentioned dharma a little bit. Can you explain a little bit the meaning of dharma for individuals? Because it can, like in the Gita, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you know, everyone has their own dharma. Yeah. Why is it different for everyone, and why is it not the same for everyone else?
Dharma is the same, but dharma varies in our life according to our profession and our position, our life, and whatever it is. For example, that's why, to give an example, I can give an example. The same Manu makes a statement. Manu speaks about higher spiritual values, but he says in one context, an householder, who neglects his duty and who does not work hard to get to gain wealth, money, to look after his family, or it may be mother or her family, and look after the relatives, he is going against dharma. So frequently we have a feeling that dharma means only spiritual things. No. So, a farmer or a teacher, a farmer who doesn't do his work, or teacher who doesn't teach well, or student who doesn't study well, in all these matters, husband who doesn't look after his wife, wife who doesn't take care for husband, both ways, children, father, in all respects. So, in its detail, in its application, it may vary from position to position, status to status. But then, the fundamental principle is the same. In many ways, dharma is obvious to all of us. We feel the doubt because we are not very sure, we don't really want to practice. That problem is there. See, for example, a student doesn't know that it's his duty to study. So if you ask, what's my duty? His duty to study. Work hard, get a good grade, get a good job, become an ideal citizen of the country, and contribute to the totality of culture, wealth of the nation.
But does it end up classifying someone or limiting someone?
No, it doesn't do that. Actually, an householder, for example, an householder who neglects his duty to his children or family or husband or wife or parents and so on, who doesn't look after that, is practicing adharma. doesn't bother about it. And if he says, well, what is the use of acquiring wealth? I shall be poor. He's actually atharma. But then those who have gone beyond this stage, you led an householder's life, and then you reach maturity, 70 or 80 years, then you want to spend some time, maybe in modern times, in old age homes. If there are people who don't think of living a contemplative life at that stage, you know, still, you find, I had occasion to visit old age homes, and what I saw was terrifying. They were watching the Terminator 1, 2, 3, 4, one after another, you know. So, they should be reading the Bible, they should be reading the Upanishads, they should be reading some mystical literature, things that teach us higher values, that goes beyond all these things, you know. So for them, it is wrong to do that. So that's why it is different from status. It doesn't mean the spiritual values, spiritual teachings are relevant only at that stage. But I'm giving an example, very pointed example. So, for an average citizen, the duty is to work hard, to be an ideal citizen, and to be an ideal husband or wife or father or mother, son or daughter, whatever may be, ideal member of society. That's his duty. And along with that, if he practices these yamas as far as possible, then he turns to spiritual life. So, that's why there is no real difference between, there is not a wide gap between the spiritual and the secular, the spiritual and non-spiritual. So spirituality goes beyond the normal, conventional meaning of the term. An householder who looks after his thing properly, he's doing his spiritual life. It's a wonderful thing. So mutual understanding in society, for example, parents who should look after the children, children should respect, look after the parents when they get old. So all these are parts of this. They are doing spirit. They are leading a spiritual life if they do that. The dharma and spirituality are the same for them. That's the meaning. The word dharma itself, you know, dharitayi dharma, that which preserves, supports, that guarantees the continuity, safeguards a social structure from falling down. That's when you do your duty, whatever may be your role in society or family, when you do, if you are a sincere person, you are actually supporting social structure. So, becoming a law-abiding citizen, a responsible member of the family, a responsible member of society, that itself is dharma for any average person. So acquaintance with great spiritual literature may help us, may give us a higher ideal of the same dharma, as you find here. I gave the example, you know, in Mahabharata, there are many stories, wonderful stories, where great householders doing their duty properly, without going to temple every day, without formally leading a spiritual life, but doing their duty in total unselfishness, practicing all these virtues, that lands them in spirituality. So spirituality is a universal thing. So you find these yamas are so universal. It involves all these yamas. For example, Brahmacharya is mentioned continence. It doesn't mean that one should not become an householder. Common people are an householder. But it means there is a restraint which enables you to go beyond the biological, beyond the physical dimension of personality. So suddenly you get a higher idea of human life and human destiny when you have a higher concept. As I said, many of the Upanishad rishis, the rishis, the great sages of Upanishads and Vedas, they were retired householders. Fine. You know, the teachings. Many of them are great monks also. There's no distinction. Each learned from the other. There are stories in the Upanishads where monks learn from householders. Householders also learned from monks. There were monks who became monks, took to spiritual holy life right from the infancy, and later learned from householders, sages. The higher life this distinction vanishes. So dharma, in a way, is a very universal paradigm.
Please. I was thinking of the man's question here, that it's sort of Arjuna's dilemma. And that each person, I mean, in the diversification of consciousness, which is so multifaceted, I mean, it is really a joy to know that there's so many levels, so many dimensions in diversification of consciousness, but each one has a sav dharma, which is the individual dharma to fulfill. And I think that's what I wanted to share.
Very good. This is a very fine idea. In fact, every individual has his own position, his own duty, his status in society, in family. According to that, his dharma may vary. But there is a common central principle. In the midst of all the diversity of different modes of application, the common principle, I mean, these yamas, these moral ideas are related to dharma. That's why an householder, let's say a soldier like Arjuna, who does his duty to fight, to help the poor, the weak, to protect the weak from the weaker, strong people, or maybe poor. And now he is doing his best to support society, to preserve values. So dhairite iti dharma. Dharma is preserving, that we support, that preserves. So it's a spiritual duty for a man like Arjuna to fight. But fighting itself, from a very superficial point of view, it is not good. But if a soldier whose duty, who is guarding for a place, and maybe a school, the small children studying, if there is a problem, if the soldier runs away because he's wrong to fight with these people who are coming to attack the school, it is adharma, it is opposite of dharma. So it varies. There is a verse in Yajnavalkya Smriti, it's a very interesting one. It says, any action that gives you the feeling that you have done what you ought to do, and which again helps a society, and we support the social values, society as a whole, is dharma. One, there's a very subjective interpretation. When we do our duty in a given manner, with full application, out of that performance of duty, you get an inner feeling, well, I have done what I ought to have done. Nobody may notice it, but you will feel within your system. This is the indication that you have done your dharma. So, niyatam kuru karmattum, Lord Krishna, niyatam means that which automatically comes to you as a duty. As I said, you know, a soldier who is guarding a school, a soldier, a policeman who is going, he's guarding the street. If he doesn't do that, then I have not done my duty. When he does it, he gets duty. That action may involve a bit of violence. That violence is not violence. So, in the commentary say, so, himsa or violence and its opposite, non-violence and ahimsa, have got certain meanings which need very long interpretation. So, an action that involves what may appear to be physical violence, but if that action supports social values, it preserves social values, and out of that duty you feel, well, you have done your duty. That is dharma. So, himsa is not dharma. Actually, violence is not dharma. But a policeman's violence to save, to protect people from violent people, becomes a dharma, you see. So, so you can see how an action becomes dharma or adharma. And not only that, it is ahimsa, it is himsa, not to protect the poor from the weak from the strong, the good from the wicked. There it becomes himsa. Protecting becomes non-violence or ahimsa. If that the act of protecting involves even violence, still it is non-violence. So anyway, but really speaking, I'll tell you one psychological mystery. Once you do your duty, not sincerity, your inner voice will tell you, well, I have done my work. Ultimately, that's the one criterion. The unmistakable, the infallible judgment that comes from within ourselves. We can always understand. That's why there is the Atman, the consciousness, the divine spark within us. That's why we feel, well, I have done my duty. It is called in Sanskrit, there is called Kridarthada. Kridakritida means the feeling, well, I have done what I ought to have done. So that's fine. So that is the ultimate judge, our own inner conscience, which never fails. So, Om Shanti, 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 Hari Om, that's it, Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu. Next Friday, we have no class. Next Friday will be, I think, 4th? Fifth, yes. Fifth, there will be no class. Because we have Vivekananda Jayanti, Swami Vivekananda's birth celebration, birthday celebration on 6th. That is on 6th. So it cannot be 5th, I think. Swamiji, 6th. So no class on 5th February, Friday. So next class will be after 5th February.